This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
The National LGBTI Health Alliance held its 8th conference, Health Indifference 2013, Our Bodies, Our Minds, in Melbourne in April 2013. Joy 94.9, Australia's only radio station for our diverse communities, is proud to partner with the Alliance to bring you this recording of the 2013 conference.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Susan. Good morning, Mr. Talbot, was the appropriate reply, but you've missed your cue. So welcome to our third and last day, and let's kick off. I'm sure a few people might have been rolling on last night and will therefore roll in this morning and join us at some point during this really important plenary session, which is addressing the range of health and wellbeing issues for intersex, trans and gender diverse people in Australia. In terms of our program this morning, there has been one program change, and that is Councillor Tony Briffer is unfortunately sick. Tony contacted us yesterday and so can't be here today. But we're absolutely delighted that Morgan Carpenter, the National Secretary of OII Australia, has been able to fill in at the last moment and join the speakers of this plenary. So looking forward to that. And now I think that's all I have to do this morning other than sit back and enjoy the speakers. So I'm really delighted to hand over to our co-chair, Sianne McLaughlin. Sianne works for the Northern Territory AIDS Council and has been working around trans issues for the last 20 years, I can say, at a guess, and has been very involved in the trans community in the Northern Territory. And last year, we were delighted when Sianne was elected as a member of the board of the National LGBTI Health Alliance. Thank you, Sianne.
Good morning, everybody. I'm terribly, terribly nervous, so you'll have to forgive me. I'm more into talking on the microphone in a nightclub after a few vodkas and bell lighting. Just pretend. Let's go. Okay, everybody, welcome to the Intersex and Trans and Gender Diversity. The first speaker I'd like to introduce this morning is Peter Hindle from A Gender Agenda. Peter Hindle is a founder member and the executive director of A Gender Agenda, which is an Australian-based trans and intersex organisation that has been operating since 2004. Peter has attended and presented at a range of national conferences on issues of sex and gender diversity, and is also the convener of the National LGBTI Alliance Diverse Sex and Gender Working Groups. So please put your hands together for Peter Hindle.
So here I am, the trans person who's been asked to talk about trans health issues. I will be followed by an intersex person who's been asked to talk about intersex health issues, and then by a genderqueer person who's been asked to talk about genderqueer issues. There's an implication in this programming, an implication that's unspoken but very present, and it exists not just in the programming of this session, but also in the newly adopted terminology intersex, trans, and gender diverse. And I want to speak about that implication not because I have any issue at all with the new terminology, but because, as evidenced by the programming of this morning's session, terminology can be really powerful in providing a framework that informs the discussions that we do have and also the discussions that we don't have. In providing a framework that actually changes the work we do and don't do. And it does that without us even being conscious of it. So I think it's good to name this so that we have an awareness of its power and that we can make conscious choices about the frameworks that we actually choose to use. If I'd been asked to talk about trans health issues as the only speaker in this session, I would have, as I always do, spoken about the health issues that affect all of our community. I've just used that word, community. I always use it, and it always gets me into trouble. I know that it's a term that many intersex, trans, and gender diverse people do not connect with because it doesn't represent your experiences. But I use the word community because all the work that I do at Agenda Agenda is based on the reality of us being intrinsically linked to a very real community. It's a community that includes intersex people, transgender people, gender diverse people, cross-dressers, their partners, parents, children, and allies. But whether you call it a community or you use some other word to describe that, there is actually something very real that binds all of us together. The fact that current ideas about binary sex and binary gender and the related assumptions about expression and identity do not match our lived experience. So, I'm a trans man. Does that mean that I'm not allowed to talk about issues that affect trans women? I'm able-bodied and middle class. Does that mean that I'm not allowed to talk about the intersectionality of disadvantage and marginalisation that affects so many other people in our community far more than it affects me? I'm white. I have no religious affiliations. Does that mean that I'm not able to talk about the complexities of understanding gender, identity, and sexuality within different cultural contexts? That I'm unable to talk about the disassociation between cultural identity and gendered or sexual identities that I've heard so many Indigenous Australians and other people from around the Asia Pacific region speak of? I define my own sexuality in a completely non-binary way that I as yet haven't found words to actually describe. Does that mean I'm not allowed to talk about the issues facing trans people who choose to identify as gay, as lesbian, as bisexual, or as heterosexual? I ask these questions because that is exactly the position that purely representational politics leaves us in. Earlier last year, I presented at a conference in Los Angeles. I was completely blown away by just how debilitating their notion of representational politics was, because it meant that no one was prepared to talk about any issue that didn't directly affect them. It meant that nothing anybody said could be engaged with critically, because to question a person's view within that context means it can only be understood as questioning that individual's identity or that individual's experience, and neither of those things are things that any of us have any right to question. The more disturbing thing I noticed, though, was that this reliance on representational politics meant that the only voices that were heard were the voices that were physically present. Someone tried to start a conversation about the intersectionality of disability and non-conforming gender identities, and they were completely shouted down because everyone in the room was able-bodied. And no one was prepared to say anything about issues related to disability unless there was a person with a disability in the room who was doing all the talking. It's a stark reminder, I think, of just how counterproductive this reliance on representational politics can be, because there was a reason why there was no one with a disability in that room. And the reason is because people with disabilities are more marginalised, more invisible, not just in broader social contexts, but within our own communities. When representational politics says we refuse to speak about the issues affecting anyone who isn't here, it further invisibilises those who are already the most invisible. It further marginalises those who are already the most marginalised. I'd like to introduce a concept of shared responsibility as a mechanism for addressing some of these issues. I was recently in Nepal representing Australia at a UN Asia Pacific regional consultation on sexual orientation and gender identity. There were no intersex people present. I don't claim to have any personal experience of being intersex. I don't have that experience. And I don't claim to be an expert on intersex issues. I am not. But in that room in Nepal, I think it was critically important that I spoke up about the lack of intersex inclusion. And not just to say there are no intersex people here and there should be, but also to say these are some of the issues that I hear intersex people talk about. And as a starting point, we need to at least put those issues onto the agenda. I'm not suggesting by saying that representation by and for intersex people or any other marginalised group is not a completely necessary thing. Of course it is. And I'm not suggesting that my voice is the best voice to be heard on intersex issues. Of course it's not. But in the absence of any other voices, I think that I, and not just I, but all of us, have a responsibility to raise not just the issue of invisibility, but the substantive issues as well, to the very best of our ability. And even if there are other voices present, I think that I, and not just I, but all of us, have a responsibility to be active and to be critically engaged in those conversations. There are ways that we can actually do this respectfully. They rely on us taking responsibility to be connected to the most marginalised and the most invisible parts of our community, to make an effort to understand all of the issues, not just the issues that affect us personally, to accept the autonomy of marginalised subgroups to articulate the processes and the solutions that are going to work best for them, to find the point of commonality that allows us all to move forward together, rather than for some of us to move forward at the expense of others. Identifying different people and different issues that exist within our community doesn't mean that we can't work together. Quite the contrary, I believe really, really strongly that we can work together much more effectively than we can work on our own. If we view our struggles as separate, it can be inviting for the trans activist to appropriate the meaning of intersex, to mount an argument that trans people are entitled to particular rights because we suffer a biological condition, because we have no choice, because we were born this way, we can't help it. But the real reason that trans people are entitled to legal and medical rights has absolutely nothing to do with that. It has to do with the fact that we are people. When we work on our own, it's too easy to forget the human rights-based framework that is so effective at promoting change. It's too easy for us to start using strategies that seek to bring about change for one section of our community at the expense of another. It's too easy to get sidetracked by the minutiae of difference instead of staying focused on the joint work that is far more powerful at achieving real change. By way of example, within an intersex-specific context, one of the many important issues is about trying to stop unwanted medical intervention that seeks to normalise children who are identified as being intersex. Within a trans-specific context, one of the many important issues is about increasing access to hormones and hormone blockers for young gender-questioning people. When viewed just at this level, those two issues seem at first to be diametrically opposed. One is about wanting less medical intervention, and the other is about wanting more medical intervention. But if we step back, there's actually some really powerful common ground, and the common ground stems from a shared belief that every individual is entitled to autonomy over their own body. This is a belief that's in line with human rights-based principles that are embedded within Australian culture. The problem in both those cases can be articulated as a common problem. And the solution can also be articulated as a common solution. The solution is about changing the way we regulate medical intervention. The diversity that exists at the minutiae level actually adds weight to an argument for change. The fact that intersex people want more regulation of intervention and that trans people want less regulation of medical intervention actually shifts the whole framework of the debate. Out of a space of asking the question, do we need to change the way we regulate medical intervention? And into a space of saying, it's obvious we have to change the way we regulate medical intervention. How is it that we best do that? I think that that's really powerful stuff. And it's stuff that is far more powerful when we lobby together than when we lobby alone. Working together effectively is not about pretending the differences between us don't exist. It's about acknowledging that they exist, finding common ground, and advocating from a position where we shift our diversity from a liability into an asset. But to whatever degree we choose to work together or to speak respectfully on issues affecting other parts of our community, there are inherent power imbalances that are really, really important to acknowledge. I think the position of trans in this regard is really interesting. After so many years of coming at the end or being dropped off what was then the LGBT umbrella, we, and when I say we here, I mean trans people specifically, know exactly how it feels. We know exactly the way that we told gay men and lesbians that they should be inclusive. We as trans people have an opportunity here to actually put into practice the things we've been telling other people they should do for the last 20 years. We get a chance to model best practice, to engage with intersex people, genderqueer people, organisations and issues in the way that we want other people to engage with us. To be conscious of the subgroups within our diverse community that are more marginalised and less visible, to allow autonomy without refusing to take some shared responsibility, to see who isn't engaging, and instead of asking what's wrong with them, to ask what is it that we are doing wrong that means they don't feel able to engage. I came here with 6 more neatly typed pages of fully formed sentences that I was going to continue with, but last night I took a rather rash decision to keep them for another time, because there's actually nothing that I can say about trans health that hasn't been said before. And I think there's some other important things that I can say today. We have heard all through this conference that we're here, the L, the G, the B, the T, and the I, because we agree that there is value in working together for the benefit of all of us. This statement has been made in good faith by every person who has uttered those words. And it's been acknowledged by each one of us who has nodded our head in agreement. And it's as a direct result of this that I think I'm feeling brave enough to be a little bit more real about some of the issues. I suspect that what I'm about to say, that some of it will be challenging. I hope that all of it will be thought-provoking. I offer it in good faith, in the hope that it will generate constructive conversation, because I actually think the time now is right. I want to talk about the grouping of LGBTI. I want to start by saying very clearly that the L, the G, and the B are about sexuality. The T is about gender identity, and the I is about biological sex characteristics. They are three quite separate things, but they're also three things that we all have in common. Everybody in this room has a sexuality. Everybody in this room has a gender identity, and everybody in this room has biological sex characteristics. But there's an implication in that kind of ticker box acronym that says you can only occupy one of those spaces at any given point in time. For trans and intersex people, this means that our sexuality is completely invisibilized within that acronym. It's not just our sexuality that is invisibilized. That also happens every time we collect and report on statistics that are grouped under the LGBTI umbrella. And it doesn't matter what those statistics are about. It could be mental health or discrimination or suicide rates or homelessness. Because the fact of the matter is that in all of those areas, the situation for trans and intersex people is significantly worse. And every time we amalgamate those statistics, we hide that disparity. We make our needs more invisible than they already were, and we make it harder to actually start doing anything about those issues. There's another important inherent tension in LGBTI, because at the core of it, what trans and intersex people are trying to do is to reduce or remove our current reliance on binary notions of sex and gender. But the very concept of binary sex and gender is completely necessary within the way we currently conceptualize sexuality. You cannot place yourself as gay or lesbian or bisexual or heterosexual unless you first identify yourself as either a man or a woman, and secondly, identify the person you are with as either a man or a woman. A lot of things have changed in the last 20 years. Gay and lesbian people have made significant advancements, which is a good thing, but it also means that the gap between our positions underneath that umbrella is getting wider and wider. It means that the issues that impact on us most, that affect us most, that we most want to be doing work on, are getting further and further apart. And in this context, how is it that we as a movement make decisions about what our priorities are? It's true that the relationships of gay men and lesbians do not receive adequate recognition at a Commonwealth level. It's also true and internationally recognised that non-consensual surgical interventions on intersex people are a blatant breach of very, very fundamental human rights that constitute inhumane treatment and torture. How is it that we as a movement make transparent and ethical decisions about what we think the most important priorities are to work on, about where we think it's most important that we direct our limited energy? I'm reminded of something that someone said at the thing I was at in Nepal recently, a guy from Thailand who said, "Winning the right to have my relationship recognised is a poor consolation prize when I don't have the right to autonomy over my own body." The things that I've just talked about are some of the reasons why some trans and intersex and gender diverse people choose not to be part of LGBTI. When I think about the people that we work with, some of them, and it's quite a significant number of them, just don't and just never will identify as part of LGBTI. For us, to reach them, it means that some of the work that we do has to happen outside of that umbrella. All right, now I'm feeling really, really brave. There's something else, yeah, that I think just needs to be said. We talk a lot about discrimination and stigma, and we talk a lot about the degree to which trans and intersex people experience that discrimination and stigma. But we always talk about it as if it's being done to us by other people, when in fact there is a very real and a very long history of that discrimination being done to us by gay men and by lesbians. And I think it actually is a really important thing for us to just acknowledge. These are conversations that we haven't really yet had. And although they're challenging conversations, I think they're conversations that we actually do need to start having. Because asking questions about what we work on, how we work on it, and with who else we might choose to do that work are really, really good things to be asking. It's a kind of reflection that makes us more responsive, more coherent, and more mature as a movement. The good work that we do together should be work that we actually choose to do together, not stuff that just happens because we never questioned that it could be any other way. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Who would like to ask the panel some questions?
Yes, good morning. I'd like to say to the panel, thank you very much for opening dialogues that I think are drastically needed to understand all three areas that you've covered. To Peter, I would like to say, as one trans activist and advocate to another, I salute you for what you're doing. Please continue.
Next, please.
I'll try to be brief. I knew when I came in this morning, knowing the people on the panel are people I love and admire so much, it was going to be good, but you've exceeded my expectations infinitely. I'll try to keep it brief. There's so much going through my head and heart at the moment after that. It is really hard to do that. But I have to say, similar to what Kathy said, Peter, someone once said, leaders don't create more followers, they create more leaders. God damn it, you're a leader. that was just awesome. The only thing I wanted to add to it, which I can't quite get the words into a question, but something happened after those of us who were privileged enough to be at the foundation of what became the Diversity in Health booklet, those who were leaving Sydney and flying home, were sitting around the airport lounge having a soft drink. And a lot of us there, intersex, trans, gender, queer, were saying, well, we're sort of getting somewhere, but that B isn't, that bisexual. And I'd planned to do this afternoon as recommendations, but I feel my heart says I've got to put it up now. I'd ask the Alliance in the next short to medium term to consider doing what it has done for seniors and for intersex, trans and gender, queer, for bisexual, pansexual, because I feel now if we are getting some sort of strength, we have to pass that on, the same as the good gays and lesbians, if I can use such a term, have passed that on to us. And yes, I totally acknowledge what you've said. So I suppose if I can try to formulate a question out of all of that, what can we do? Can we just get some starting thoughts on how we might have that debate? And also, I suppose the other question, how do we keep the debate safe about having this debate about the double standards under the rainbow that you touched on as well? So there's my two questions. And it's two or three of you.
Sally, the question about how we keep having these discussions in this space. I don't think I have the answer. I think I think the important thing is that we continue the respectful dialogue, that we're prepared to hear each other on that. Like I don't think I don't think we need to structure in a particular way to have that, but just to go that debate's, well, not the debate, the conversation has been opened, and let's engage with it. And I don't think they, like, they are tricky questions. I don't think the answers are simple, and I don't think we're going to work it all out overnight. We're going to make mistakes on the way, and I think we just need to accept that we're going to do that, but the important thing is that we keep trying to move in the right direction and trying to do that together.
I'm Mish Pony. I'm the trans sex work representative for Scarlet Alliance, the Australian Sex Workers Association. I suppose this question is for Peter, but anyone can have a go. There's a lot of writing and theory that's come out of North America and more recently South America about the intersection of sex work legislation and the health and well-being and citizenship of trans women. What's your opinion of this and how it translates to an Australian context?
Intersectionality of sex work and trans women in particular. I so don't claim to be an expert on those issues at all, and I haven't read the material that you refer to that's coming out of North America. But my immediate response would be that there's a whole range of different levels of marginalisation and intersection between those, many of which we haven't adequately addressed. And I think sex work is definitely there, and it's certainly an issue that affects a lot of trans people. So again, I'd say the same thing. It's really good to get it on the table and to keep getting it on the table. I'm going to go away and do some research based on your question. So next time there's a question about that, I feel better informed about what those issues are and how to engage with them. But I think there is a lot of work. I mean, there are active sex worker organisations, certainly in the ACT, and I have a sense that's national. And I think there's some really strong overlap and some really good work that we can do in collaboration between those groups.
I just wanted to talk about toilets because I understand very much from what I've heard the importance of having toilets like they've been labelled here today, so there's not male and female. But I just wanted to also make the point that for a lot of lesbians, mixed toilets can be unsafe places, in fact, for a lot of women. So I was just concerned that if there's the idea that public toilets generally, that I'm talking about in terms of sexual assault and one in four women being sexually assaulted in their lifetime. So I just wanted to make that point that there is some concern, I think, about women going into toilets that might be mixed and how safe that might be.
I actually disagree that. I agree, having spent the better part of my life as a woman, I agree that there, what is real is a fear that toilets are unsafe places for women if men are there too. And I know that's real because I felt it. But I also know, as a trans person, that toilets, whether they're men's toilets or women's toilets, are really unsafe places for us, not just in terms of that fear, but also in terms of interactions that happen when we are using those facilities. I think that if we're really serious about, I mean, I think there are things that we can do to address the safety concerns that all of us, and I mean all of us, have in different arrangements in facilities. But I think it's really good to acknowledge what was acknowledged here, and I think there are some, you know, really simple practical ways that we can actually solve those problems, like, for example, privacy, single stall setups, bathrooms that anybody can use that aren't about multi-user spaces but are just about going into one room and having privacy within that space. So I think we can actually work through those issues, but it's important to put it there.
I would just like to formally thank all of our speakers this morning that have talked about some amazing issues. Can you please put your hands together for Peter Hindle?
You have been listening to a recording from the Health in Difference 2013 conference held in Melbourne in April 2013. For more information about the National LGBTI Health Alliance, head to lgbtihealth.org.au. And for more information on Joy 94.9, Australia's only radio station for our diverse communities, explore joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.